Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We share reports every day here on WILL AM 580 about the financial markets, stocks going up and down, commodities being traded, as well as national and international reports dealing with employment, home sales, manufacturing, corporate takeovers, and we seek as best we can to connect all of that data to what's happening in your life. Another service we can offer is to deal directly with your financial situation, and we do that by giving you a chance to speak directly with an expert in personal finance. He's Kevin Waspy, and he is a chartered financial analyst and lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. He joins us on a regular basis to answer your basic questions about money management. Kevin Waspy, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you very much, Craig. Good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. While there is much that I could ask Kevin, and I'll spit out a few questions here and there. Really, this hour is yours. It's a chance for you to get your questions answered, whether you're just starting out and are looking for advice on investing, maybe thinking about buying a home or sending your kids to college or planning for retirement. Whatever the stage of your financial life and whatever's on your mind about your personal finances, your questions are welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or via email to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. All right, so I just mentioned, Kevin, there are lots of reports that come out that say, unemployment dropped 0.1%, or the conference board has indicated this particular economic indicator is up 0.1%. How do we take that kind of data and apply it to our own lives and our own financial situation?
That's a great question. And I think the answer has to depend on what application you have for that kind of information. It's a little bit like saying we live in an information age. And I truly believe that that is the case. It's a little bit like, well, let's learn how not to drown with all the information that's out there. So with that framing in mind, if you're an economic historian, if you're an economically involved person, someone who's trying to make decisions, manage money, or make investments in brick and mortar, if you think that those indicator series are going to give you a pulse of the economy that you're operating in and that helps you make those decisions, that's cool. For the average person to say, you know, I don't involve myself in that part of a life, I suppose they're good to be able to say, well, what was that 60-second snippet on the 6 o'clock news?
And that's enough?
And that's enough.
But I guess part of it also is that for some people there is the sense that if I don't understand what all of these reports mean, I might want to understand it, but I don't. I feel like there are others out there who do, and so they've got some sort of inherent advantage over me.
Well, we all have, how should we say, a competitive advantage over each other in certain aspects. So you introduced the show. You mentioned the Facebook page for Will Radio for the show. You mentioned Twitter. You have a tremendous competitive advantage over me in social media because I don't even know what Twitter is.
I don't know if that's an advantage. In your life, you may be better off not knowing.
in social networking, yeah. So in that field, you have a tremendous competitive advantage over me. I'm not trying to dismiss the importance of understanding what's going on in our world. Don't get me wrong. We can obsess over anything. So in the proper dosage, do I think a person going to the polls in November should have a decent understanding of how their economy works? Absolutely. Do I think that they should have some kind of an opinion based on factual information that helps them conclude, is the economy doing well? Is the economy doing poorly? And perhaps even why? Absolutely. I believe that every one of us ought to have an interest deep enough to get to be able to form what I would call an informed opinion. But to watch daily, weekly, or monthly series of economic reports out of the U.S., out of Europe, out of Asia, those are things that we could, in a day-to-day life, become obsessed with.
And I guess it would, it's extrapolating perhaps too much to try and take individual snapshot reports like that and apply them to your personal investments and make decisions based off of that.
I think that's a very fair statement. I would be hesitant taking any one or any number of them and literally saying, if X, then Y.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're welcoming your questions today on personal finance for Kevin Wasby from the College of Business at the University of Illinois. He joins us on a regular basis to field your questions about everything from investing to buying a home or paying for college or planning for retirement and really anything you might want to ask a financial advisor about your personal financial situation. Kevin's here to help. We welcome your personal finance questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we'll start with Thompson in Champaign County. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. And welcome back, Craig and Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Both back. I'm 76 years of age, and of course retired, and I have a 50-50 stock bond allocation. And I'm just wondering if it'd be smarter for me to have some of that bond allocation in utility stocks. And if so, what percentage would you recommend, and possibly what Vanguard fund would you recommend?
That's a good question, and I'll try to answer it. But bear in mind that I'm not going to try to give you a prescription because I don't think I know enough about all of the circumstances, the objectives, the constraints, so on and so forth. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
So utility stocks as a group are, how should we say, in my opinion, kind of overplayed. We all know that we live in an interest rate environment where yields close to zero are the norm. That's caused a lot of excitement, a lot of buying of utility stocks, those type of companies that traditionally pay out some pretty large proportion of their earnings in the form of cash dividends. So the yield trade has been, in play for the past 3, maybe even 4 years. I'm a little bit cautious about buying utilities at the levels that they are right now because they happen to still have some pretty attractive yields. I'd say the same thing for bonds. So let me give you a little bit of an overview. In the bond sector, I would be looking at shortening durations. So if you own bond mutual funds that have an average duration greater than 3, 4, or 5 years, I'd probably be moving out of those into bond funds that have durations of 5 or fewer years. And duration is just a fancy way of saying similarly to an average maturity of the paper in the fund.
Right.
The reason I don't think utility stocks would be suitable for that type of comparative move is because utility stocks theoretically have no maturity. So you potentially are maximizing your potential exposure to a decline in value when interest rates go up. Now, I'm not predicting when they're going to go up, but I don't think they're going to stay at zero forever.
Sure.
Okay. All right.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call.
Bye.
And we'll go next to Jane in Mattoon. Jane, good morning.
Hi. My question, I don't know if you'll be able, I know you want specific and it's hard to know my whole financial, but we have a home equity loan, and I'm wondering, it's rather large, and I don't, it bothers me because I'm 66 and retired, and I'm wondering if I should take money from the IRA, which is not, I have some in an IRA which really isn't returning any more than what I'm getting paying on the home equity loan, which is about 3%. So do you think I should take it out of the IRA to pay off the home equity loan or try to just keep making payments?
Well, if I could ask just a few questions without getting into some real deep specifics.
Yes.
What was the purpose for taking out a home equity loan?
To remodel the kitchen and help finance, pay for a car.
Okay.
New car.
Okay. And is there a first mortgage in addition, or is it is
no,
this
the
only?
No, the mortgage is paid off.
Okay, so this is the only debt on the house.
Right.
If you used a very conservative estimate of the worth of the house, what you could sell it for tomorrow, perhaps, what would you say as a percentage the outstanding debt is to the value of the house?
Probably about 1/8.
So 12.5%.
Right.
Okay. Good. 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 Well, I'm saying good, good, good because you don't have a first mortgage, so we're not talking about another piece of debt, and the debt against the house is roughly 12.5%. I understand why you would borrow against the equity in the house to improve the house. That makes sense. I'm a little bit uneasy about borrowing money to buy a car and using the house as collateral to do so. The only reason I would say that that makes sense would be from a tax purpose. Obviously, any interest on a car loan is not a tax-deductible expense.
Well, I've already done that. My question is, now that I didn't borrow very much for the car, but now should I go into my IRA savings to pay down this home equity loan?
I wouldn't. Just on the surface of things, but I'd suggest you do something different with the home equity loan. I'd suggest you put a permanent 30-year mortgage on the house and replace that home equity loan with a permanent fixed-rate 30-year mortgage.
Oh.
Okay. When you got your home equity loan, I'm presuming that there is some short-term, maybe every year, maybe every 2 years, either the need to refinance, the loan comes due, or the interest rate adjusts, okay? So let's take advantage of the zero interest rate environment if you want to borrow money and lock it in with a 30-year fixed rate loan. Now, that goes against my grain of borrowing money just because I'm a cheapskate, okay? I don't like to borrow money. Period. End of story. That's my bias. I got to disclose that to you. But if I'm going to go against that bias, if I'm going to say, in your situation, would I take money out of the IRA? Would I create taxable income solely for the purpose of paying off what I think is a bad loan to be in? I would say no. Pay it off cheaper by getting a 30-year fixed rate loan and literally have the option available to you at any point to pay back that 30-year loan in its entirety, no penalty, or make the minimum monthly payments for the next 30 years. See, that gives you flexibility, and it gives you security of a fixed rate for 30 years.
Okay.
30-year fixed rate loans right now are running about 3.5%, which is probably the same or less than your HELOC, your home equity line of credit.
Yes.
So there you go.
All right. Okay.
Great. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
So I guess the main thing, the main lesson to draw from this is if you do something like a home equity loan, in many cases, there's going to be some sort of variable interest rate associated with it. The potential could be there that after a period of time, suddenly you're paying a lot more debt on it, a lot more interest.
Exactly. A home equity line of credit is a little bit like a convenience loan. So let's not call it something like a credit card, but let's call it a structure where you're paying one way or another for the convenience of having that loan. It's an easier loan to get, and consequently, it will either have maturity dates that are, you know, 2, 3, 4, at most 5 years. It may have interest reset dates that are every 6 months, every year, so on and so forth. It exposes you to potential risk because it's a convenient loan to get.
But if there is a benefit, it's a quick infusion of cash pretty fast.
Yeah,
right?
If I had a 60-day need for money and there was no other way to get it, it might be the quickest, easiest way to get some meaningful sum of money for a short-term use.
But as soon as you can get out of it, you should.
But, you know, yeah, exactly. I've just never been a fan of, how should we say, convenience at the expense of my housing.
Let's go next to John in Moultrie County. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. Enjoy it.
Sure.
I have a question. It's not exactly personal finance, but it's financial. It's something I heard Terry Gross talking to a guest yesterday morning at the 11 o'clock hour. It had to do with the way corporations collect state income tax. It was, if I understand this, and I think they went through it twice because Terry obviously didn't understand it too well either. But what I think I heard is that corporations collect their state income tax from you. Just they do federal and FICA. But most of them, or all of them, or something like that, have agreements with the various states that they get a tax credit for collecting that. And as I understood what they were saying, the money then does not go back to the state. It essentially stays with the corporation. Did I hear that correctly? Do you know, could you help me out with that?
Yeah, I'm pretty ignorant of that topic, and I'm certainly unaware of that conversation that you might have listened to. I didn't hear it. Mm-hmm. I'm struggling a bit, and I'm way out on a limb here. But I want to make sure that if I were to investigate it, what I would actually be looking to investigate. Here's what I mean.
All right.
When we say corporations, do we mean my employer? If I work for Caterpillar, my employer is required to withhold from my wages a payment of federal income tax for me personally.
Yes,
and, I understand. And a payment for the state of Illinois income tax personally for me. So I can't get out of, nor can Caterpillar, get out of withholding monies that are due to the state because of my personal income tax obligation, either to the feds or the state.
Yeah, that's the way I understand it, too.
If we're talking about that, I'm struggling to see how that tax liability on Kevin Waspy could have any bearing on the tax liability of Caterpillar.
Well, that's kind of why I'm calling, too. I'm also struggling with the idea.
Right, right. My only guess is that there was some nuance in there that is, you know, something that neither one of us understand. I didn't listen to the show, and the nuance was tight enough not to be understood by you, the listener.
And I'm sorry to say, in my case, as soon as we're off the air here on Focus, I've been preparing for the Afternoon Magazine. I haven't had a chance to listen to Fresh Air in recent days, so I didn't catch it either. Sorry to say.
Well, I just, like I say, I'm calling because, like you, I understand that they don't have to turn it in immediately, but, you know, 6 months or a year annually. But it didn't, I just couldn't believe they never turned it in at all. I'm like you, I didn't understand it. And Terry, like I say, she went through it twice, and it seemed to be he was saying the same thing. She was interviewing the man who wrote about the lousy internet service we have in this country and how the corporations lobby against it.
All right. Well,
and they got into tax implications and things.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, since it's not really directly on point, well, I'm just going to move on just because we've got some other callers, but thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Ron, who's in Atlanta, Illinois. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, and nice to talk to you. Before the rally downturn quite a few years ago, I talked to the guest, or I didn't talk to the guest, but I listened to the guest, and he recommended in my situation exactly, not referring to me, to ladder out CDs right then. And I took his advice from the radio conversation, and it worked out tremendously well. But now, unfortunately, a lot of those CDs are starting to expire. And right so far, I've reinvested them in real, real short-term CDs, just hoping something new would come along here with interest rates.
Why did you break the ladder?
I didn't. Well, they just came due.
No. The whole purpose of the ladder, and it's a two-step process, remember?
No.
Okay, well, then let's refresh. The ladder of maturities works like this. Imagine rungs on a ladder, each one of them being a term to maturity.
Correct.
So 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year. When we set up that structure, so let's put a fifth of our money in each bucket. When we set up that structure, we're also making a promise. A year from now, when that first maturity appears, unless there's some dire need for the money or change in your objectives, that money immediately goes into a new five-year CD.
Okay.
Each maturity gets rolled into the top of the ladder. You always end up with a fifth of your money coming due every year. You always end up with a blended average yield of the highest spot on the yield curve. Now, when I say highest spot on the yield curve, I know the yield curve changes. So in other words, 5 years ago, interest rates at every maturity were higher than they are now. But the yield curve is still upward sloping. That means a 5 year still pays more than a 1 year. See what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And that's exactly what
I did. Okay, so step two, though, step two has to be followed as importantly as step one. Set up the ladder, and then 365 days later, you're going to get a notice in the mail. Well, 344 days later, because they're going to send you a notice 10 days early. They're going to say, hey, your one-year CD is coming due. What do you want to do with it? The last thing you do is ignore the notice and let it roll over for another one-year CD. Because remember that two-year CD a year ago? Well, it now has 1 year to go. So your action is to take the maturity and roll it back to the top of the ladder. Now, you didn't do that, so now you're sitting with money liquid as opposed to a ladder.
Well, I kind of did that, except I just didn't roll them out to the 5 years because I didn't want to accept that low of interest for that period.
Oh, because you knew interest rates were going to be higher, right?
Well, this has just happened here recently because...
Okay. No, I'm not trying to beat you up.
No, I mean, there's still lots of CDs that haven't rolled over. In other words,
okay.
Maybe one has come due, rolled over now.
Okay, well then unless you have an alternative need or use for the money, then go ahead and take maturities and roll them out.
Continue your ladder.
But
I haven't been rolling them out for the 5 years. I've just been rolling them out for...
Did you change the rungs on the ladder?
Well,
let's go back to step one. Were they set up? How were they set up for maturities?
Probably exactly like you said.
1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 years.
Yes.
Okay. If I looked at your ladder now, would I find rungs of 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 years with the same amount of money in each?
No.
Okay.
Now most of them are going to come due in a shorter period of time.
Well, the only way they can be coming due in a shorter period of time is because you didn't take it out. You didn't take a maturity and roll it to the end of the ladder.
That's true.
You changed the rungs on the ladder.
That's true.
Okay, good. I see, I'm not trying to beat you up. I'm just trying to understand where you're at.
Yeah, so right now, as they come due, say, out of...
Well, go put the ladder back in place.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm doing, except the ladder's shorter term.
Well, no, you're not.
Yeah, because now...
No, it's not exactly what you're doing. You've changed the ladder. Now, if you want to change the ladder because you have an alternative use or need for the money, that's fine. If you want to guess or predict where interest rates are by your actions of saying, oh, those rates are just too low, I'm not going to go buy another 5 year, that's another matter. You've made a conscious decision to forecast interest rates. And that's okay. That's okay. That's your prerogative. But be honest with yourself and admit that changes what happens to the ladder. And now it exposes you to what interest rates may or may not do in the future.
Good or bad.
Good or bad. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Again, I'm not beating you up. That's not a problem. But we have to be honest with where are we and how did we get here?
Okay, so as long as I kind of continue along the same line, I'm not too bad, and you wouldn't recommend, since, we talked, we don't need the money, there's no other alternative things right now that would be as safe and all the things that were discussed in the original premise of this idea.
Our Federal Reserve has told us that they will have a zero interest rate policy in effect through 2015. That's been extended three times. They started out saying 2012, 13, 14, now 15. I mean, I'm only saying that 2 years from now, if you don't continue to keep your ladder in place, now literally here's what I mean. Stick with the original plan. Okay, that's what I mean. Stick with the original plan. If you don't stick with the original plan, there's a very real possibility that 2 years from now when you call in and we have this conversation, all of your money will be liquid. You will have no ladder. So the choice is yours.
Well, the ladder will be completely different, but there would still be a ladder. It'd just be.
Well, maybe it'll go from 6 months to 18 months.
True.
Okay. So it's still a car. It just happens to be in a junkyard and not running.
True.
Okay, good.
But the other could happen also. So if,
absolutely. If interest rates spike up in 18 months, you're the big winner.
And if they, if all my money is at a lower interest rate because I've laddered it out, which it would be, that isn't, that's going to be close to zero anyway.
I have a great saying that summarizes all of our discussion. Ready?
Ready.
If ifs and buts were candies and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas.
Well, I really appreciate it, and your advice last time was some of the best I ever had, and it's worked really well for me, so thank you very much.
Well, don't continue to follow it then.
Well, I probably didn't quite understand what it is.
Sorry about that.
I just had to follow it. I mean, I haven't lost, very much so far, so, I mean, I can get right back on the ladder again.
Well, it tends to be a strategy that works over time, and that's the key. Any strategy that works over time requires that you continue the strategy. So thanks for calling.
Thank you. Yeah, this reminds me of a conversation I had back in 2008 when the economy was, spiraling and we were all collectively freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a family of financial planners, and my brother, I had asked him to speak to some folks that I was working with at the time, because we all had lots of questions about what was going on and what it meant for our investments. And something that he said it just parallels what you just said, which was stick with your original plan. Whatever it was you had identified as the appropriate path for your financial future before things became really chaotic should still hold. Eventually, the market will in some way return, but think long term. That's what he sort of kept reiterating. Stick with whatever that original plan was.
Right. I can't agree with you more. The only little caveat that I'd throw on top of that is if you find that it doesn't work for you. So there are strategies, many and varied. Okay. That latter strategy is what I would call grade one strategy. There's nothing esoteric about it. There's nothing intricate about it. If you look through history, take any series of interest rates and any changes in them that you'd like to make that strategy apply for. So back test it. What you'll find is it's simple arithmetic. It just seems that you'll end up with an average yield and half of your money due at the midpoint of your ladder. It's arithmetic. Now, when things get more esoteric, when things get more conditionalized, and when things get more intricate, strategies might have to change.
Well, people's circumstances sometimes can change, too.
Because right. If there are huge shifts in the way things are working, that might require an intricate strategy to be changed. And as you pointed out, a secondary reason, which is 9 times out of 10, the reason you change a strategy, 9 times out of 10, the motivator and the need to change strategy is the change in the person's circumstances, objectives, needs, constraints, whatever you want to call them. Absolutely.
We have some more folks waiting on the line. We want to get to your calls in just a minute, but we are due for a short break. This is Focus.
Monday marked the 150th anniversary of the bloodiest single day of battle in American military history, the Battle of Antietam. On the next Fresh Air, historian Drew Gilpin Faust tells us how the massive scale of death during the Civil War challenged fundamental assumptions about life's value and meaning. She's the author of The Republic of Suffering. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting the comedy drama Steel Magnolias from September 27th through October 7th. At Truby's Beauty Salon, six very different women share their secrets, fears, and loves with grace, determination, and perfectly coiffed hair. Information and reservations at 351-2528.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your questions this hour about personal finance for Kevin Waspy from the College of Business at the University of Illinois. He drops by from time to time to field your questions about everything from investing to buying a home to paying for college or saving for retirement. Anything you might ask a financial planner or financial advisor is welcome. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL. We received a question via Facebook from Ryan. He says he's 23, has a monthly check of $125 coming in for the next 7 years in addition to his wages and other income. He says, I feel I should put that toward retirement after I finish saving up for financial hardship. What should I do with it?
I admire his question. I admire his suspicion that he should be saving the money for the future. That's the most important ingredient, coming to that realization. So bottom line is what to do with it. Let's start out with what capacity to use. If you're building a nest egg for emergency purchases, for emergency purposes out of your current wages, that's good. But I would say the first thing you need to do, particularly at your age, is think of emergency use of money, the kind of, the rat hole account that's more important than retirement savings. So I'm presuming you're doing that out of wages. Now with the money that we're talking about in addition, I would say that the first and easiest thing to do is probably establish what I would say is, again, I'm assuming on a wage and a tax situation, set up a Roth IRA account. The Roth IRA account is not going to give any current year tax advantage because the contributions to it are not deductible against ordinary income when you prepare your income tax. But there are many other advantages that will come later in life through establishing the Roth IRA. So just on the surface of things, I would say the money in excess, I would set up a Roth IRA account. Now, the next question comes, well, what happens under that umbrella called a Roth IRA account? Because when we think about the structure of an account or the status of an account, that's what we're saying with a Roth IRA as opposed to a regular IRA, as opposed to a personal investment account with a brokerage, with a mutual fund company, so on and so forth. So in other words, under the umbrella of a Roth IRA, what are we going to do with the money? I would suggest the easiest thing to do and probably the most prudent thing to do for a person who does not want to be a student of financial markets is to set up a relationship with a mutual fund company like Vanguard. I don't make anything for giving that recommendation. I only acknowledge that they're the lowest cost provider of a mutual fund package of families. So the funds that they offer are some of the lowest cost products available to accomplish long-term investment objectives. So a family of funds, Vanguard, the opportunity to go into different stock funds, different fixed income funds, and do so in a very cost-effective way.
We have a number of folks waiting on the line. We'll go next to Chris in Winona, Illinois. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Well, how are you?
My husband passed away and had a SEP IRA. I know I can transfer it to a regular IRA, but I just wonder if that's a thing to do or if I should look into something different.
I'm sorry for your loss, but Could you repeat the first part? It kind of broke up. Who passed away?
My husband passed away.
Ah, okay.
And he had a SEP IRA.
Yes.
And I can transfer it into the same kind of an account or something different, and I just don't know what to transfer it to.
Yes. A spouse has the prerogative for a retirement account, whether it's an IRA, a Roth IRA, or a SEP IRA. The spouse has the prerogative to inherit that. So basically change the name on the account. Certainly you should go through the process of converting that into an IRA in your name. And now the question again, like our previous little discussion, what to do with the money that's under the umbrella called the inherited IRA. And to that end, again, I have no idea what your circumstances are, what your needs, objectives, constraints, so on and so forth are. So I'm not going to be able to give a very good answer to you over the phone. But structurally, yes, as a part of settling an estate, make sure the IRA is now, how should we say, properly transferred to the IRA in your name.
Okay. All right. And just because there were so many things out there, like it was some kind of somebody gave me an annuity to look at, and I don't know. I just seemed like maybe that was just too much for me. I thought, well, if I just transfer it and just put it in my name now and just leave it the same way, structured the same.
Well, that's certainly the first step. The second step, I would say, is you probably should get with someone that you would trust that could give you advice that would be unbiased to the point of what might make sense for you. And when I say unbiased, I'm not saying unfair, and I'm not trying to implicate anyone's intentions. But when we talk to an insurance agent, they have a bias, and that is the product or products that they sell. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I'm not trying to impugn anyone's integrity, nor am I trying to call anyone a scoundrel. But these are inherent biases, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So generally speaking, if you think the amount of money is meaningful to your future, then it's in your best interest to seek out someone. Word of mouth is the best way to discover who an unbiased financial advisor is that you might meet, potentially develop some rapport and trust with, and then follow some advice that they might prescribe that you could say, yes, that makes sense because I understand what it's accomplishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like everybody I've talked to wants to sell me whatever they've got.
It is a huge industry, and you're wise to recognize that. And again, that's why word of mouth, find a person who is in less a position of being biased in the recommendations they will make.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
And we have an email from Michael in Champaign. He says, I might retire at 62 in about a year. He says, this fiscal cliff stuff is making me nervous about my 401k. He wants to know what your thoughts are about how conservative he should be. He says he has about $260,000 he plans to buy an annuity with. He says he has about 20% in the stock market, 50% in a fixed account, and the rest in international and some other things.
That sounds like a pretty conservative mix already, just on the surface of things, without seeing exactly what the funds are or what the portfolios look like. But again, with 20% in equities, with 50% in what you and I would kind of compare to a CD, a guaranteed rate product. These are CD-like instruments or contracts issued by insurance companies. So I'm suspecting the 401k is probably custodianed or trusteed through an insurance company as a corporate-sponsored plan. And then the balance in international things. So again, I mean, just on the surface of things, 50% in a GIC, guaranteed investment contract, as they're technically called, and 20% in equities with the rest kind of scattered. I don't know what more or less I'd do to make changes. I think those changes, once the decision of retirement is done, is probably more important than worrying about what does or does not happen with the, quote, fiscal cliff. All of this stuff coming up at the end of the year is like the next Joker popping out of the deck.
Well, I think a lot of people are also just wondering, when do I cash out? What's the year, the moment at which I say, you know, if particularly people that are close to retirement, at what point do I stop investing for the future and start spending for the present?
Right. Part of that is answered for us by the tax code. The money in a qualified retirement plan, whether it's a 401k, a 403b, our own IRA, unless it's a Roth IRA, we're going to be subject to minimum distributions when we turn age 72 and a half. So, I mean, the IRS wants to get their cut, and that's one of the ways they're going to get you to do it. They're going to force distribution. But that's another hurdle that's, you know, quite a ways off, let's say another 10-plus years. For this individual, again, I think the fiscal cliff is least important on the, priority list.
Mm-hmm.
Make the decision about retirement. Once that decision is made, now, again, seek out somebody that can go through a complete understanding of what the person's objectives are, how they think that money fits their future, what their lifestyle wants to be, and the rest of the assets that are in place.
It raises one other sort of key question, which is, how do you know when you've saved enough?
Well, you know when you save enough because you give more away than you make. Okay, so when you cross the threshold of donating more money to charitable purposes each year than your income, you know you've crossed that threshold.
I imagine there are a lot of people that never get to that threshold.
Well, in terms of numbers, yes, yeah. But there are a lot of people. I mean, look around the campus. A part of this building that we sit in right now is named for a person who was that type of person. And this was a person that came from modest means. So the Jack Richmond studio, just to the south of where we sit. As pie in the sky as that sounds, you know you've saved enough when you're giving away more than your annual income each year. As pie in the sky as that sounds, with some amount of prudence, with some amount of good luck and hard effort, more people get to that point than you and I would actually imagine on the surface.
Let's go next to David in Urbana. David, good morning.
Yes. I can offer an explanation of the question about corporations receiving state taxes from their employees.
Okay.
This is usually a case of a multinational which is given the option of collecting the taxes, which they are obligated to do, and then not paying them to the state as an inducement to locate within the state or to stay within a state. It's very similar to concession where the state agrees to waive the taxes that are owed by the corporation.
I understand now. That makes perfect sense. So the state of Illinois tries to lure business to the state for all of the good reasons that we'd like to have an employer here and productive employees, so on and so forth. And the way they give their tax break that they promise to the corporation, instead of swapping checks, is to net it out.
Yes.
Yep. Okay,
and
great.
It is somewhat more opaque, let us say,
sure,
than the concession. And it could be done in conjunction with the concession of waiving this corporation taxes to increase the incentive.
Sure, sure. No, that makes perfect sense. Now, it's as if you lure me to your house to do a job and you say you're going to pay me $25, but I have to pay a $5 toll when I bring my helper along. So we could swap checks. I could give you a check for $5. You could give me a check for $25. or we could just agree that we could net it out and you give me a check for 20.
Essentially that. Mm-hmm. Just thought I'd offer the explanation.
Very good.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
And while we're in the process of explanation, there have been a couple of terms that have come up over the course of the hour that I don't know that we've maybe described clearly enough. One was laddering. What,
mm-hmm.
what do you mean? I assume that that's a strategy for investing. But can you explain
sure.
a little bit what,
sure.
what you meant by that?
When a person is looking at fixed income investments, so whether we're talking about CDs at a bank, individual bonds, perhaps, to a lesser extent, even things like mutual funds, but we run into a different problem there. So let's just constrain our definition
mm-hmm.
to things like CDs or individual bonds. A ladder of maturities is what the total strategy is called. A ladder of maturities, meaning that all of the money does not come due at the same time. So whatever sum of money we have, just as a simple strategy, and there are many variations of it. A simple strategy would say break the money into five equal pieces. One-fifth of it goes into a one-year CD, one-fifth of it in a two-year, one-fifth in a three, a four, and a five. So at the time the ladder is set up, just like looking at rungs on a ladder, we can see that a fifth of our money comes due every year for the next five.
Mm-hmm.
When a year passes, and we all know how quickly that happens anymore, you'll have a maturity notice. And that money does not roll over in another one-year CD. That's what happens automatically if you ignore the maturity notice at most banks.
Mm-hmm.
If you ignore the maturity notice on an individual bond, well, then obviously you are paid off and there's just cash sitting in a money market account if that's where the money is held. Bottom line is you have to take the second step of the action. And if your needs for the money have not changed, then you take the matured amount and you buy another five-year CD.
So that you're always constantly...
You're always constantly recycling...
every year.
You're always constantly okay. recycling the money. You're always constantly ending up with basically a half of your money coming due at the midpoint of your ladder, or just to say it simply... In our example, you have a fifth of your money coming due every year.
And by the time you get to that fifth year, you're already in five-year CDs all the way around.
It's exactly.
Just, they're just coming to maturity each year.
So here's the arithmetic that I like to work for people. Excuse me. If interest rates don't change, after 4 years, you will be earning the five-year rate on all of your money.
There it is.
That doesn't sound too bad, with a fifth of your money still coming due every year. If interest rates go down, they have to go down by a sufficient amount so that when a one-year CD matures, the reinvestment rate on a five-year CD is lower than what the one-year rate was. And every year, that iteration just changes by one. So in other words, 2 years from now, the only way I quote-unquote lose my rate of return when the two-year CD matures is if the two-year CD rate now matured is higher than a new five-year CD.
Got it.
Okay, so I'm going to call that your cushion event because I'm going to believe interest rates can do three things over time. One, they can stay the same. Two, they can go down. Three, they can go up. Okay, so I'm going to give you two out of three right off the bat where you're the winner. If they stay the same, after 4 years, you end up with a five-year interest rate. If they go up, that's the bonus season. Every time you get a maturity, you're renewing into a five-year CD that now has a higher rate of interest. The only time you lose, quote unquote, is when interest rates go down, but that's a cushion loss because they have to go down so significantly such that your mature rate is higher than the new five-year rate.
We have just less than a minute left. Another term that came up, somebody who had emailed us referred to the fiscal cliff. What is that a reference to?
Oh, well, as our tax laws are currently structured, at the end of this year, the Bush tax cuts, as they're referred to, expire, and the budget agreement put through last year by Congress that forcefully cuts across the board spending in all federal programs occurs. So this is sort of like the Armageddon event for some people. It's sort of like the automatic pilot. Gee, if we can't agree, this is what will happen by default. I think we all know that, you know, autopilot is not good for complicated situations. I hate to call it the fiscal cliff, but that's the phrase that's kind of come about. What will Congress do? Man, if I could predict that, predicting the future of a stock market would be easy.
Since we are out of time, we do have one question via email, and I was hoping maybe you'd deal with that off the air.
Sure.
Terrific.
Absolutely.
Kevin Wasby is a chartered financial analyst. He lectures on finance in the Department of Finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. Kevin, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Craig.
And, of course, we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to will.illinois.edu/focus. On Monday's show, we will welcome your questions about the care and maintenance of your home. For Scott Spees from the Spees Home Inspection Service, we invite your questions on everything from windows and siding to roofing and gutters to attics and basements, just about anything that goes into the single-family home. And if you're thinking of making some changes or something needs to be repaired, you are welcome to call. That's on Monday's show. And Tuesday, interesting conversation ahead. Amid so much political corruption in Illinois in recent years, how does the rest of the country view us? Do they see us all as a little bit corrupt? We'll talk about it. Today's show is produced by Travis Stansel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.